chat, and already we're developed a little bit of rapport. Mr. Gromberg is a senior editor and a columnist for the Jerusalem Report, where he also writes on political and religious issues. In addition, he is a regular contributor to the New Republic and an associate of the Center for the Millennial Studies at Boston University. He was co-author of Shalom, Friend, of The Life and Legacy of Yitzhak Rabin, which won the National Jewish Book Award. American-born, Mr. Gromberg was raised in California. He holds a MA in education from Hebrew University and a BA in religious studies from the University of California, Santa Cruz. Now a dual citizen of the U.S. and Israel, Mr. Gromberg resides in Jerusalem. Tonight we are privileged to hear his comments on his critically acclaimed latest work, End of the Days, Fundamentalism and the Struggle for the Temple Mount. I thought I'd make a couple of quick remarks, my own, if I may. Some of this is prepackaged for me, but this is mine, and I don't know if it makes any impact on any of you, but it's something that I thought I wanted to say. The generational healing process, instead of beginning the easing of the conflicts over in Israel, over in the Mideast, have caused more problems in the Mideast. Those potentially fair-minded young people on both sides of the issue cannot take any leadership roles as long as the killing continues. The rampant hostility is creating a new and even more vicious anger. Maybe a good place to start the mending is in the Temple Mount. Maybe that might be the first place where you might be able to find ways to get together. Who knows? The site where two Jewish temples once stood and where two Islamic sanctities now stand, the Dome of the Mosque and the Al-Aqsa Mosque, is, according to Mr. Gromberg, the most contested piece of real estate on earth. More than that, there are millions of monotheists, look it up, don't understand the word, but that's all right. Check it on the internet today. I do not know what monotheists are. Someone please explain it to me later. Around the world who believe that the condition of the building atop this man-made hill in Jerusalem will have a role in the fate of the human experience, indeed, of the cosmos. It therefore behooves us to know the issues surrounding that site, which is what we're talking about tonight. Our format for the evening will be first to hear Mr. Gromberg's remarks of approximately about 20 minutes, and then Daniel Pipes will moderate a question and answer period of 15 minutes. I'd like to ask you at this time if any of you, like myself, to turn off your phone and please any other electronic devices that might ring. After the program, dinner will be served in the boardroom for those who reserve places. On behalf of the Middle East Forum, please join me in welcoming Gershon Gromberg.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank Daniel Pipes and Jerry Sorkin and Jim Meister for making it possible for me to be here this evening. There's an old Jewish story about two gentlemen who come to a rabbi with a financial dispute. And first, Moshe explains his case to the rabbi at great length, and the rabbi says, "Moshe, you're right." At which point Yankel says, "Excuse me, Rabbi, you haven't heard my side of the story," and he explains his side of the story at even greater length, and the rabbi says, "Yankel, you're right." At which point the rabbi's wife says, "They can't both be right," and the rabbi says, "You're right too." There's another version of this story I should note. Rabbi says to Moshe, "You're wrong." And then he says to Yankel, "You're wrong." And the rabbi's wife says, "They can't both be wrong." And he says, "You're wrong too." either way, the story reflects the fact that sometimes our picture of reality has to be composed of various stories, versions that seem contradictory, and yet without keeping them all in mind, we won't really understand what's going on. And I think that the Temple Mount, 35 acres in the southeast corner of the old city of Jerusalem, is a place that demands that kind of thinking, that kind of keeping in mind the various stories, because the Temple Mount that matters is constructed out of the stories that people tell about it. I should note that I'm already taking a position by calling it the Temple Mount, whether I like to or not. The names that Muslims use for it are either Al-Haram al-Sharif, the noble sanctuary, or Al-Aqsa, the furthest mosque. And the moment you use one name or the other, you sided with one story or the other. I often have editors ask me, do you have a neutral term for this place? And the answer to that question is no, there is no neutral term, there is no neutral story. So in terms of your right and your right too, let's start with the question, did the Al-Aqsa Intifada, as the Palestinians call their current uprising, begin at Al-Aqsa? At first glance, that's the equivalent of asking who's buried in Grant's tomb. Obviously, the Al-Aqsa Intifada is about Al-Aqsa. But Ariel Sharon insists that his visit to the Temple Mount had nothing to do with this uprising, that it was pre-planned, a strategic decision by the Palestinians. And both Ehud Barak and former Foreign Minister Shmuel Ben Ami agree with him. Normally, these three people can't agree on whether the sun is up or not. So this is very unusual. Now, it's true that Barak and Ben Ami have a vested interest in arguing that the Al-Aqsa Intifada did not begin at Al-Aqsa because they permitted Sharon's visit to the Temple Mount on September 28th of last year. But beyond that, they are making an argument which has repeated itself for over 70 years. In 1929, the first countrywide outbreak of violence in the Arab-Israeli conflict took place. And it began at the Western Wall, and it began over the issue of the use of the Western Wall at the edge of the Temple Mount and of the Temple Mount itself. And many historians and observers asserted that at that point, the Mount was really not the issue. This was a conflict between two national movements. The Mount was incidental. For that matter, there are those who assert that the early 1980s Temple Mount plot, in which a group of radical rightists in Israel got so close to the carrying out of blowing up the Dome of the Rock that they'd actually built the specially constructed explosive carriages that they planned to strap onto the pillars of the dome. There are those who assert that that also was not about the Temple Mount. It was about Israel's withdrawal from Sinai, which the conspirators hoped to stop through blowing up the dome. In each case, I could say of this argument, you're right. There's a national struggle going on between Jewish nationalism and Palestinian nationalism, between the nation of Arabic speakers and the nation of Hebrew speakers, and it's a much wider issue. The Mount is really incidental to this. And 1929 was the first explosion of violence in this national struggle. The 1996 tunnel riots, which also began at the Temple Mount, was really the breakdown of the peace process. The current uprising is the complete breakdown of the peace process, and the Temple Mount is at most a bit of the scenery in this conflict. But I would argue that the opposite view, that the Temple Mount is central, is equally important and at least equally right, because to exclude the Mount from the question is to exclude the value, the importance of symbolism, of religion, of the stories that people tell about their own past in this conflict. It is to assert that a conflict is only about territory, about control, about the practical issues. What the Temple Mount represents is the symbolic side, the mythic side of the conflict. It is a symbol of hope and aspirations and fears for both sides. And the function that a symbol plays is the function of a concave mirror. It reflects wider energies and focuses them in a single point. Sometimes it focuses them so well that it sets fire to that point. The Temple Mount focuses all of the other issues and tensions between Jews and Palestinians on a single place, and at that place things have burst into flames again and again. So in order to understand that, we need to ask what is, in fact, the symbolism of this place. Why is it so important? Why is a plaza of 35 acres of such critical importance? The paragraph that those of us in the journalistic trade keep in our computers to slam into every story about the Temple Mount is that, I love computers, it makes work so much easier, is that the Temple Mount is the site of the first and second Jewish temple in ancient times, and it is the place where, according to Islamic tradition, Muhammad arrived on his night journey as described in the Quran, ascended to heaven, met God, and received the commandment of prayer five times a day for Muslims. The moment I say that, you will notice that we have moved in the space of a few sentences from history to sacred history, to the imagined past of a group. It matters little for this purpose whether Muhammad was actually at the Mount or not. What matters is that millions of people believe so. Historians discuss at exactly what time in Islamic history did Muslims agree that the furthest mosque, or Masjid al-Aqsa, described in the Quran, became, in the minds of Muslims, the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. Was it 100 years after the Prophet lived? Was it 150 years after the Prophet lived? For academic purposes, that's a good question. For the political purposes of today in the Middle East, it's completely irrelevant. What's relevant is that hundreds of millions of people believe that that's where Muhammad ascended to heaven. For that matter, the Palestinians argue consistently today that the Temple never stood on the Temple Mount. Now, I would say that from an archaeological and historical perspective, they're completely wrong. But for the purposes of the Palestinians, their real mistake is it doesn't matter. What matters is that the Jewish people believes that that is where the temple stood and believes that that is the holiest spot in Judaism. And that is the strategic fact with which the Palestinians must contend. The story, the shared belief, is what matters. Now, if I've mentioned sacred history, I should point out that there's much more to the sacred history. According to Jewish tradition, the Temple Mount is also the place where Abraham bound his son Isaac to the altar. That's based on a verse in Genesis which refers to this almost sacrifice as having taken place in the land of Moriah. And the Mount Moriah is later identified as the Temple Mount. In other words, it is the place where the ultimate religious individual underwent the ultimate religious test and founded the faith. Just as in Islam, the furthest mosque is the place where the ultimate religious individual underwent the ultimate religious experience, ascending to heaven, and founded the faith. This is the spot in both religions where the true faith began. It's also the spot in Jewish tradition where Adam was created. It is the spot in Islamic tradition, a hadith, a tradition attributed to the Prophet, where the second mosque in history was built in the time of Adam. It followed the Kaaba in Mecca, which according to Islamic tradition was actually built by Adam, by the first person. So it's not just the place where tradition of faith began, it's the place where the world began, where human history began. It's also the place, according to the traditions of three religions, where the world will end, where history will end. In Jewish tradition, since the destruction of the Second Temple in the year 70, to say, may the temple be rebuilt, is synonymous with saying, may the Messiah come, may God's kingdom on earth be established, because the traditional belief is that's when the temple will be rebuilt. In Islam, Jerusalem, and specifically Al-Aqsa, is the stage of the end. The Muslim Sheikh Bassam Jawar of Al-Bir has said, Islam began in Mecca and will reach its conclusion in Jerusalem. The final judgment will take place, according to Islamic tradition, at Al-Haram al-Sharif. A bridge, the thickness of a thread, will be stretched from the Mount of Olives to the Haram, to Al-Aqsa, and the souls of all who have ever lived will have to walk that bridge. If you were a good person, you will make it across. If you were not, you will fall off and be damned. So that's where the world will end. At least in the interpretation of the New Testament, embraced by tens, if not hundreds of millions of fundamentalist and other evangelical Christians around the world, the Temple Mount is also essential to the scenario of the end in Christianity, because the third temple must be built, according to this theology, before Jesus can return. So once again, it becomes the place where the world will end. In other words, this spot is the place where history begins and ends, where faith begins. It is the center of the universe. Take the bus to Jaffa Gate, walk through the marketplace, be careful to step over the garbage, turn left, and you arrive at the place where the world began and ends. It's a lot to put on one place, and it makes it crucial politically, but there's another fact that makes it crucial politically, which is, besides being a religious symbol, it has become a political symbol. It is both at the same time. All of these traditions around the Mount could be interpreted metaphorically, allegorically, and often have been in history. But we live in a time of ascending fundamentalism, religious beliefs that interpret text literally, and so it's literally the real Temple Mount that is seen as occupying this role. In addition, we live in a time when events are actually happening on the physical stage of the Holy Land that seem, for many believers in all three faiths, to line up with the prophecies of the end. If I say to you, I'm going to do something really big tomorrow, that's a prediction. If tomorrow I rob a bank, then something really big is robbing a bank. If tomorrow I discover a cure for cancer, then something really big is discovering a cure for cancer. The event provides the interpretation. So again, to quote Bassam Jawar, the events are the best commentary on the text. If the Jews return to their land, if they reestablish a state, if they conquer Jerusalem, and you're looking at verses in either the Hebrew Bible or the New Testament that at least in vaguer terms seem to indicate that those things are connected with the end of days, then we must be approaching the end of days. And if something that big is happening near Al-Aqsa, well, perhaps we're approaching the end. So in all three traditions, it's very easy to interpret the political events of today, at least for some believers, as apocalyptic events, events indicating the end of history as we know it. In addition to that, both Jewish and Palestinian nationalism have a very particular view of history. That view of history is that history is divided into three periods. There is the ideal past, where the nation lived on its land, as it should. There is the disrupted, awful present, where the nation is in exile from its land, and there is the ideal future where the nation will return to its land. If that's your political approach, the most logical symbol to borrow from religion for national purposes is that symbol which represents the ideal past and the ideal future, the Temple Mount, or Al-Aqsa. So in both Jewish and Palestinian nationalism, from the beginning of the national struggle 100 years ago, Al-Aqsa has become the icon, the emblem of both groups of people's hopes and aspirations. In 1928, Menachem Ussishkin, a nationalist leader, said in a speech in Jerusalem, "Let us swear that the Jewish people will not rest or be silent until our national home is built on Mount Moriah." The word home is the same word in Hebrew used in a different context as temple. So you can also read his sentences meaning, "Let us not rest until our national temple is built on Mount Moriah." Now, in context, his comment meant, "We want independence." But the emblem of independence was that building that should be built on Mount Moriah. And on the other hand, from the beginning of the Palestinian National Movement, the way to engage, recruit, mobilize not only Palestinian Muslims, but Muslims around the world in their support, was to emphasize the alleged danger to Al-Aqsa from the Zionists. So the same place became the center of both people's national consciousness. That only increased after 1967 when Israel conquered the Temple Mount. For secular Zionists, when an Israeli colonel announced on the army radio to his commander, "The Temple Mount is in our hands," that meant that Zionism had fulfilled its purpose. The Jews had fully returned to their land. For at least one major version of religious Zionism, that was the ultimate proof that prophecies were coming true and that we were on our way to the coming of the Messiah. For Muslims, on the other hand, Al-Aqsa, under Jewish rule, was the starkest possible symbol of the threat to the Palestinian nation and to Islam itself. And Al-Aqsa became even more the symbol of Palestinian nationalism and of the Islamic revival among Palestinian Arabs. So that today, if you walk into any office in East Jerusalem or in the West Bank or in the Gaza Strip, you will find an immense aerial photograph of Al-Aqsa on the wall. It wouldn't be a Palestinian office without that. Often there are hand-painted pictures of the Dome of the Rock in Palestinian homes in a strange historical mirror image of the image of Jerusalem that was often traditionally on the walls of Jewish homes. The same place, possession of that place, became the essential condition of independence for both groups of people. At the same time that, as I mentioned before, Christian fundamentalists were closely following what was going on in the Holy Land in expectation that the Jews would build the temple and thereby bring about the end of days. And often supporting radical Jewish groups at the very fringe of Israeli politics who sought to build the temple. Those groups are a tiny minority in Israel, but they're just enough to keep the anxieties and fears on the Islamic side in some tiny basis of reality. The old line goes, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean nobody's out to get you. So the assertion that's common in Palestinian circles that the Jews all want to build the temple is completely wrong, but there are those few people out there who want it to provide proof, in quotation marks, over and over again. And some of those groups, strangely enough, receive moral and even financial support from believing fundamentalist Christians in the United States and elsewhere in the world. How has this affected our political situation? Well, last July at Camp David, the two sides, the Israelis and the Palestinians, came together to negotiate a final status agreement. And one of the issues that they had to decide was the future of Jerusalem, and specifically of the Temple Mount. They couldn't do it. As a matter of fact, even what one side saw as a generous concession was perceived on the other side as a dangerous threat. The spot was too loaded with symbolism for them to come to any kind of agreement. In hindsight, it's clear that the Israelis assumed that at the end of the Oslo process that the Temple Mount would remain in Israeli hands, and that the Palestinians were certain that at the end of the Oslo process, Al-Aqsa would be theirs. Both things couldn't happen. Ehud Barak suggested that the Mount Al-Aqsa, or whatever you want to call it, be under de jure Palestinian administration, but under the roof of Israeli sovereignty. For Israelis, that looked like an immense concession. For Palestinians, that looked like a demand, an untenable demand, that Al-Aqsa would remain under Israeli sovereignty. the two sides couldn't talk about that. Worse yet, after the summit, the Palestinians made more explicit in public than ever before the position that had become widespread in recent years that the temple never stood on the Temple Mount, that there was no Jewish historical link to Al-Aqsa. For Israelis, that was virtually an assertion that there was no Jewish history in that land. It was an assertion that the Jews were simply European colonists come lately. And if that were the case, were the Palestinians at all serious about making peace? So the trust was eroded further. The Palestinian assertion also, in my opinion, virtually functioned as an engraved invitation to a nationalist Israeli leader to assert Jewish control of the Temple Mount, as Ariel Sharon did when he visited there on September 28th. The Sharon visit, accompanied by hundreds of police, was, in Palestinian minds, yet another proof that the Israelis never intended to end the occupation. They weren't even willing to give up Al-Aqsa. From there, things got a lot worse. So the symbol functioned to galvanize all of the emotions on both sides, to stress the gap between the two sides rather than any progress that had been made toward an agreement. By the way, since that time, I've repeatedly seen on fundamentalist Christian websites assertions that the current conflict between Israelis and Palestinians is proof certain that the end of days have indeed begun, because the battle for Jerusalem, which will lead to Armageddon, has obviously started. Everybody can stand around the Temple Mount. The Temple Mount is, in essence, a three-sided stage in which the believers of true faith can stand each certain that they understand what's going on that stage, even if each of them is holding a different program in their hands. If that's the case, is there any hope whatsoever in the future of reaching a compromise about the site? Well, unlike some of the people I've described now and who I wrote about, I'm not one to engage in prophecy. And only a prophet would know whether we can ever reach a compromise at this place. But if anybody wants to make the effort, I think that the first step will be to recognize the power of the symbolism, to try to understand what that symbol means to the other side, and to tread very carefully. One of the major problems at Camp David was that neither side made that effort, and the results were catastrophic. I'd like to finish with a very ancient Jewish story from almost 2,000 years ago. According to a Jewish text, the three rabbis were debating why Cain killed Abel. The Bible doesn't quite say. It says that one of them said something to the other, but what he said isn't written there. The debate was really a debate about how does violence come into the world? Where does murder come from? Because that's the first murder. One of the rabbis asserted that they were fighting about a woman. Aggression, at least male aggression, according to his version, began with sexuality. Perhaps that's the version that Sigmund Freud's father taught him. The second version, the second rabbi asserted that they had an argument about how to divide up the property in the world. One was to get, according to their agreement, immovable property, one the real estate. The one that got the real estate told the other one to fly, get off my ground. The one that got the movable property told the other one to strip, take my clothes off. And that came to blows into murder. Murder aggression is a materialist issue. The third rabbi asserted that they agreed peacefully how to divide up the world until they got to one problem. One of the brothers said, "And I'll get the place where the temple will be built." The other said, "I'll get the place where the temple will be built." And over the Temple Mount, the first murder was created, over the assertion that you could own God, own the path to truth by owning this place, and murder came into the world. Sometimes at night, listening to the gunfire out my window from the line between Palestinian Bethlehem and Jewish Jerusalem, I think about that story and realize that in 1,800 years we've learned very, very little. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Gershom Goenberg. This is the man to turn to understand one of the most complex topics of our time. As I noted earlier today, Mr. Goenberg is one of the few people who make me feel beer deficient. But nonetheless, I'm delighted to be standing here with him. I'd like to again thank Jerry Sorkin of J.M. Sorkin for making the connections this evening that made it come to pass. Mr. Goenberg, you should know that only about a block away from here, maybe two, if you go into an office of the PNC Bank, one of our major banks, you will find a similar skyline of Jerusalem with the Al-Aqsa and Dome of the Rock very prominently displayed, just like in Arab East Jerusalem. And the reason for this is rather startling. It's a PNC bank, but it used to be the branch of Bank Leumi in Philadelphia. So it's not just the Palestinians, and at this point it's not even just the Israelis. Let me start the questioning by asking you, what would happen, do you think, if we woke up tomorrow and found that this ancient, fragile, man-made hill had been destroyed, that some incendiary device went off, and at least the southwestern quadrant of it, with the Dome of the Rock, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and the Western Wall, were destroyed? What would follow?
That's a question which has been discussed by Israeli security experts and indeed Israeli courts. After the Temple Mount plot was discovered in the early 80s, it was actually discovered accidentally, rather bizarrely. The members of the conspiracy had engaged in other acts of terrorism and were arrested for those acts. And under questioning, they mentioned that they'd originally gotten together to destroy the Dome of the Rock. The judges in the case asserted that the destruction of the dome, not the whole mount, but simply the dome, held the risk of an explosion of violence that could bring the entire Muslim world against Israel. Another judge in the case asserted that it held the risk of a second Holocaust. Now, those are the extreme cases. Obviously, again, engaging in prophecy is a dangerous thing. I think that the overall impact, however, of any physical damage to the site is very dependent on the diplomatic and political context. If an extremist of one side or another tried to damage the dome in a time of relative dialogue and at least efforts for peace, it is possible, though certainly not assured, that leaders could keep some control over the infinite. If it were to happen under circumstances similar to today, the effect could be far worse. And therefore, one of the major concerns of Israeli security services is preventing any attack whatsoever on the mount and specifically on the Dome of the Rock. The reason for the Dome of the Rock being the center of the concerns is most archaeologists believe, and for that matter most rabbis believe, that the dome stands directly at the spot where the temple stood in ancient times. So for those extremists who would like to rebuild the temple, the dome is a little bit of a problem. And that, in fact, was a major reason for the Temple Mount plot of the early 80s. These were people who wanted to force God's hand and speed the final redemption by destroying the dome. It was also the reason that an unbalanced Christian fundamentalist by the name of Dennis Rohan set fire to the Al-Aqsa Mosque in 1969. Nobody quite ever figured out why he hit Al-Aqsa Mosque instead of the mosque at the southern end of the mount rather than the dome, but he believed that it was necessary to clear the ground for the temple to be rebuilt and for Jesus to return. These visions sound to us perhaps as being wild, crazy, but this is a situation in which religious extremism has the potential to have an effect a very, very wide group of people, millions of people who may not share that vision but live near the epicenter. And so can we estimate the exact effect? No, we can't make predictions about how human beings are going to react, but I would very much prefer not to have to find out. Thank you.
It's a very complex treatment of a complex subject. One of my friends who has a theory of the Middle East as being, in a sense, in essence, a religious war between Islamists, not extremists, but the religious people who believe that Israel is within, I think he used the word Dar al-Islam, the land of Islam. And of course, but some of us believe that Eretz Israel is a holy land and that we are entitled to be there and that we have this equally strong belief. If that's, first of all, what's your reaction to the idea that this is, in a sense, a religious war, and then Shimon Peres' idea of materialism and, you know, raising the quality of life for the Arabs and the Palestinians to prove things? Well, the point is that this is really a religious war, no matter how many computers you gave the Palestinians, they're not going to give up the maps. And therefore, we have a new reconcilable state of conflict that's going to stay that way for
The question was, first of all, if I understand correctly, first of all, is this a religious conflict in its essence? And second of all, if that's true, is it insoluble? I don't think that you can reduce the conflict either purely to a national conflict or purely to a religious conflict. It has had both elements for all of the past century, and they're inseparable. There are two nations in conflict, but they're in conflict over a land that matters primarily because of its religious importance. Let's face it, the world wouldn't be paying as much attention if this was a piece of territory the same size in Central Asia. Anywhere else in the world, this piece of territory matters to people because it's the Holy Land. There's no oil there, right? I mean, there's no other natural resource. The only resource that the country has to offer is sanctity. There's a good grounds to believe that archaeologically the only reason that the city of Jerusalem exists is that there was a Canaanite holy place there 1,000 years before David. So it's inevitable that religious elements have been part of the conflict from the beginning. And as I said, even the most secular of nationalists on both sides have repeatedly borrowed religious imagery to make their case and, in fact, to recruit people with a more traditional background to their cause from the beginning. That's also not to say that the national element has been there. They've existed in tandem from the beginning. I would also say, however, and I say this as a religious person, that religions are not monolithic. There's a vast degree of differences of opinion within religions and a vast degree of flexibilities within religion. I'll give an example from the recent past, not in terms of the Arab-Israeli conflict directly, but something that relates to this. Last March, the Pope came to Jerusalem. A few days before the Pope's visit, there was a demonstration by the temple activists at the Western Wall Plaza against the Pope's planned visit to the Temple Mount. And after the demonstration, I walked up to former Knesset member Hanan Porat, and I asked him, what do you have against the Pope going to the Temple Mount? And that's the question that I had to ask him, and he said, I have nothing against the Pope going to the Temple Mount. He could still convert to Judaism and offer sacrifices at the rebuilt temple. After all, it says in Isaiah, my house will be a house of prayer for all nations. Three or four days later, the Pope came to the Western Wall Plaza, and he was greeted by another religious politician, Rabbi Michael Melchior, who was then a cabinet minister in the Barak government, and as a rabbi was chosen as the Pope's host at the Western Wall. And Rabbi Melchior said, we welcome you here to pray. After all, it says in the book of Isaiah, my house will be a house of prayer for all nations. It was the same place, the same verse, and radically different interpretations. One of the disagreements I have with the literalists of all three faiths is the assertion that there's one reading of a text. Religious texts aren't written that way, and human beings don't read them that way. And I do not think we are so constrained and confined by those traditions that there cannot be other readings of them. And I do not think that we need to be prisoners of particular readings. I do think, however, and this relates to part of your question about Shimon Peres' belief that if everybody just had another computer and the standard of living went up, that the Middle East would be Benelux. Religion is a crucial factor. It does not imprison us, but it has to be taken into account. A colleague of mine who's very familiar with the Camp David talk said the problem with it is that yuppies from Ramat Aviv, North Tel Aviv, were negotiating with yuppies from Ramallah and yuppies from Silver Spring, and none of them had the slightest idea of how most people in the Middle East felt about these places. The stories do not imprison us, but they are part of the process and they must be understood. They have to be understood by the people talking about these things, and any suggestions, proposals have to take those stories into account and try to work with them instead of ignoring them.
Is it true that Islam has no interest in Jerusalem, but when it's conquered by someone other than Islam, witness a year for the number of Turkish occupation rooms made foul? Is that a true concept? And the second thing is, I don't agree with your point that if something happened to the Temple Mount, there might be a cataclysm. Jerome went up on the Temple Mount and his blood found near cataclysm. The top of the rock went up in smoke. I think it could very well produce an
The question was, is it true that Islam is only interested in Jerusalem when it is contested or desired by another group, as in the Crusades of the present day? I would say that contention is half true. Jerusalem, I mean, if you go through the Islamic architecture of Jerusalem, there's huge amounts of things that were built in periods when Islam had no competition or control of Jerusalem, beginning with the Dome of the Rock and the mosque at the southern end of the Dome of the Rock, which is also goes by the name of Al-Aqsa. I'm sorry for the confusion with the names, because the same name is used for that specific mosque building and for the enclosure as a whole. But those were built at a time when there wasn't anybody who could challenge Islam in the Middle East. All you could do is get out of the way and head for cover. Vast amounts of religious building took place in Jerusalem at other times of history, and not just around the time of the Crusades. However, I think it's clear that in any time when something you love is contested and desired by somebody else, there's an intensification of your own connection with it. I mean, that's not just in the field of religion. That's the plot of romantic comedies and tragedies throughout history. The thing that we have to remember, however, is that the feeling that it's even more important to me because somebody else wants it is a sincere feeling. In other words, that's not something superficial or manipulative. When you feel that something that matters to you is being taken away by somebody else, you may concentrate your attention on it, but your feeling that I want this and I have to keep it is really there. It's for real. So if in the 33 and a half years, 34 years, since the Israeli conquest of East Jerusalem, for instance, Al-Aqsa has become the center of the Islamic revival, that is in large part, because Israel ruled the spot. But those Muslims who come to pray there, because of that, the 400,000 Muslims who came to pray on the last Friday of Ramadan in 1999 really believe that this place is holy to them in an intense fashion. And the historical explanation has a value in terms of understanding the dynamics of history, but it's not going to convince somebody else, oh, I don't really care about the place. I mean, you can't just go to these Muslims and say, well, you only really care about this place because the Jews want it. And on the other hand,
during the past couple of years, a wider and wider portion of the Israeli public has gotten concerned about the Temple Mount, precisely because possible Israeli concessions were suggested at the spot, precisely because Islamic groups are intensifying their renovation efforts on the Mount. It works both ways. But I don't think those people's feelings are insincere.
I'm not sure the questioner realized it, but that's my thesis you just asked about. I published it in the New Republic 4 years ago, and so I might slightly amend it since I am the author of that thesis. It's not so much that Muslims only want Jerusalem when it's not in their hands. It is rather that Muslims are interested in Jerusalem when it's politically of interest to them. And that, in most cases, means that it's in someone else's hands, be it the Crusaders, the British, or the Israelis. But it also includes two episodes early in Islamic history, and I won't go into much detail on that here, but two episodes early in Islamic history, one in the lifetime of the Prophet Muhammad himself, and the second in the Umayyad period, when the Umayyads controlling Damascus were in conflict with others in Mecca and Medina, and in order to build up their territory's sanctity, they emphasized the sanctity of Jerusalem. So the point is not so much that it's always in somebody else's possession, but that Jerusalem counts when it is politically expedient.
Can I add a point here? If you look at the Dome of the Rock, it's a strange building. First of all, even though today Muslims say that it's the spot of the night journey and the ascent to heaven, it was built before that at least had any consensus in Islam. The second thing that's strange about, so what's it doing there? It's a question that bothers historians. The second thing about it is that it looks very much like a Byzantine church. The third thing about it is that the verses on the inside of it are verses which assert that Jesus was a prophet but not the Son of God. And one more aspect of it is that it was built on the spot of the temple. This spot was already holy. Every conqueror who's come to Jerusalem has installed their god at the holy place. And by building the dome there, and building it in the fashion and in the exact place that it did, Islam could assert its supersession, its supremacy, its completion of Judaism and Christianity. That was at a moment of triumph. There wasn't any challenge, but it's also in relationship to the other faith.
Okay. I'm glad you raised that, because part, I think, of when part presents a very even-handed view of the attachment of the faith to the Temple Mount, the Muslim idea of supersession resulted, it seems to me, first of all, in the construction of the mosques to show that the temple was no longer valid and the mosques were in faith. But within recent Israeli history, when Jordan controlled East Jerusalem, Jews were prohibited from praying at the Temple Mount, while in the 34 years that Israel has controlled the Temple Mount, worship for all faiths has been free. This is a very big difference, and if Israelis are concerned about the Temple Mount, it may be because they remember the 19 years when they alone were excluded from the holiest sites in Judaism.
The point was made that during the time of Jordanian rule, Jews were excluded from praying in Jerusalem, praying at the Western Wall, in essence, because until 67 there was no movement even at the fringes of Judaism that sought to pray on the Mount itself, and that since Israeli rule, all religions have had access to their holy sites. I would say that that is in large part but not completely true, and we have to understand the distinction in order to understand part of the tension around the site. I think that one of the most incredible things that happened in 1967, and there are good reasons that too little attention was paid to it, that was very important, was that when Israel conquered East Jerusalem, it broke with that 4,000-year tradition and did not get rid of the previous shrine and create its own. It agreed to a division, de facto, it created a division of holy space at the Temple Mount, that Jews would pray at the Western Wall and that Muslims would pray on the Mount itself. That this was an astounding victory over history and a step toward trying to defuse the religious conflict. The reason it's not terribly noticed is because on the ideological level,
Israel's assertion was the Temple Mount is in our hands, and the de facto arrangement was not stressed in the same degree. But you also have to understand that for security and other reasons, Israel repeatedly has restricted access to Al-Aqsa. For large periods of time, West Bank and Gaza Muslims, for instance, are unable to enter Jerusalem and go to the Mount. During the current troubles, there's been various times in which, for instance, only people over 45 have been allowed to go to Al-Aqsa. The security reasons for this, I think, are completely understandable and justifiable from an Israeli point of view. But if you tell a Palestinian Muslim that there's free access to Al-Aqsa, the best reaction you'll get is somebody laughing in your face, and the reactions go way downhill from there. So, in fact, one of the greatest irritants to Palestinians about the current situation is the lack of free access to Al-Aqsa, and that was another one of the issues that came up and was not solved at Camp David.
Another one I was going to say now applies to Christian function. I very much enjoyed your emphasis on how much the labels matter. So, Al-Aqsa, like Temple Mount, or Tanakh, Old Testament, they're not just descriptive words, they're theological words. I agree entirely. But I'm a little concerned that fundamentalism and fundamentalist is exactly this kind of word. That is, when we call someone a fundamentalist, unless we're referring to someone who is a Christian fundamentalist and says I'm a fundamentalist, I'm afraid all we're really doing is saying you're religious, and you're religious in a way that I don't particularly like. So I'm wondering if you can help me understand more what you mean when you say we're living in a fundamentalist stage, or when you talk about
Okay, first of all, the term fundamentalism is originally a Christian term, and when I'm using the term relative to Christianity, I'm using it in terms of those people who would call themselves fundamentalists as a positive term, because they agree with the fundamental principles that were laid out in the early 20th century. Among those principles was biblical inerrancy, that the Bible is completely accurate, the literal interpretation of the Bible. In the community of people who consider themselves Christian fundamentalists, the dominant theology in our time is the premillennial theology, which I mentioned before, which sees the creation of the State of Israel and events after that as heralding the end of days. The use of the term fundamentalist for other religious groups is something which everybody in the study of religions loves to argue about. To what extent can that term be used for other faiths? There are those people, however, in Islam who apply the term to themselves. Among other things, they will also tend toward a literal interpretation of original or of sacred texts. There's a big debate of whether the term fundamentalism can be used regarding Jewish groups. To the extent that it can, it also has to do, I think, one of the prime characteristics of that is the insistence on the literal meaning of certain texts. Of course, there's a problem here in terms of literal meanings, because the texts themselves are ambiguous. And deciding what the literal meaning is often actually a reflection of one tradition or another. So very often those people who assert that they're being literalist, inherent in their literal meaning of the text is in fact a long religious tradition. When I said that we're living in an age of fundamentalism, what I meant to say is, in shorthand, is we're living in a time when those who assert the literal meaning of the text and the unbending meaning of the text, and very often proudly assert that they do not make moral judgments because the text determines for them completely what is right and wrong, and it isn't proper for them to enter their own moral judgments into interpretation of the text, those people often claim and are often acceded by other groups the mantle of the greatest religious authenticity and the greatest religious continuity. I think there are problems with that thinking on a historical basis. Historically, I don't think literalism was the common version of interpretation in any of these three religions. But in a strange interaction between secularists and fundamentalists today, both groups are very often willing to agree that that's what religion is. For secularists, this provides the boon that they can say, that's what religion is, and I don't like it. For the fundamentalists, it provides the boon of acknowledgement even by their enemies. For those who take a different approach to religion, a wide range of theologies from liberal to conservative that don't fit that category, it means dropping out of public view to one degree or another.
Well, again, thank you very much, Mr. Gornberg. I'd like to commend to you his book. I have reviewed it myself in Commentary Magazine. It's available on the internet under my own website, danielpipes.org, if you'd like to read it. I recommend the book highly, and it is available outside. I would ask you to please drop your name tags off. Those of you who are joining us for dinner, it is in the Fells Room. Second floor, Broad Street side, so a long hike from here in the same building. I'd like to thank you all for joining us on this lovely spring evening. I'd like to thank Mr. Gornberg for coming back and forth.